Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 368.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we hike up our sleeves for a third indictment. I'm your host, Nagin Farsad. And if I had a dollar for every time this former president was indicted, I would buy a popsicle. Today, we're going to very briefly touch on that. We'll also look at some of the conservative protests of Barbie. We'll look at legacy and missions. And finally, how to feel happier at work when quitting isn't quite an option. Today, folks, it's an all-star panel. I was saying earlier, it's one of those panels where I could just like sit back and relax because I'm with the pros. Joining us for the 1,000,000th time, it is writer, comedian, actor. You've seen him on stages across America. He's such a brilliant comedian, such a brilliant writer, and he's one of my favorite people. It is the one and only Benari Lee Poulton. Hey, Benari.
Hey, thank you. You know what? I really just only come on the show now for the ego boost. It just makes my day. I just need an intro from you, and I'm happy.
I mean, call me anytime. I am happy to deliver because I mean it, and I am so excited about this next panelist. You've heard them on the show again 1,000,000 times since the beginning. They are just like one of these people that you can depend on to have the hottest of takes, the most brilliant of insights. A writer, a podcaster. I subscribe to both of their podcasts. A filmmaker, folks, just like multi hyphenate. It is the one and only Gabe Dunn. Hey, Gabe.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Love to be back.
It's funny that you should mention the intro, Benari, because actually I got the kindest Instagram message today. And I can't remember who it was from, and I can't even find the message. I actually tried to look for the message, but it was recent. So whoever you are, thank you for sending this message. But they specifically talked about the introductions. Is there like, you're so excited about the panelists, it makes me feel excited about the show in general. And I was like, great, that's what I want. I want you to love the people I love.
You are the Josh Gondelman of introductions.
Oh my God. Yes.
Like if you need an introduction, a daily intro from Nagin and that. Yeah. And that'll get you through the day. That and then a pep talk from Josh. And now you've
and
just
then
covered
exactly,
everything.
By the way, I have done one of his pep talks, which was like, it was an explosion of positivity on that episode. Before we get into the show, I just want to remind listeners that you could go to patreon.com/Nagin Farsad. We do bonus episodes of the show on our Patreon feed. So you subscribe for very little money. You get bonus episodes. It's really fun. There was recently an episode about a dude who had pet rats and that shit is wild. It was very interesting. I want people to hear it because I want to know everything that everyone feels about pet rat having.
I had one as a kid.
Oh my God. I don't, yeah. I feel, as first of all, I feel like you should have included that in some sort of introductory email when first we met years ago.
Yeah, rat girl. Rat girl guess, to trans guy pipeline.
Guess what's going in the intro next time?
I know, exactly.
Rat person.
So go to patreon.com/NikiForsight to support the show. And now let us get into it with topic number one. We are going to cover some dumb stuff. First of all,
so the indictment.
Let's start with the indictment. I mean, so just for listeners who don't know, and I mean, maybe you don't know because there's so many indictments. How can you keep track? Former President Donald J. Trump was charged with 4 counts in connection with his efforts to subvert the will of voters in 2020. Federal charges do not bar Trump from running for president. So that still happened.
Oh, my God.
This is indictment number 3, as I mentioned. And as sequels go, it kind of lacks the luster of indictments 1 and 2. But I don't know. Tell me, how do you feel, Benari, about said indictment?
I mean, it's dumb. It's dumb that he, you know what? His criminality is offensive on a level that is, I think, unseen in American history. Because most criminals that operate on this scale have a sense of shame at some point. Mm. At some point, there is a sense of, I don't want history to remember me like this. And that's usually the final straw. That's what did Nixon in. Nixon didn't want history to remember him as a crook.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he believed that if the president did it, it wasn't a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump has taken, if the president does it, it's not a crime, to the most absurd degree, where he's just openly doing crimes, then bragging about it. And if you look at the indictments and the seriousness of the charges, they would, no one would ever bring a charge like this against a former president unless they have hours and hours of tape and documented verification of the man himself saying, I'm doing crimes. I'm doing this. I know they're crimes. I like that they're crimes, and I'm going to go do it. And the overthrowing of the government, subverting democracy, subverting the will of the will of the voters, you know, he proudly is doing that. And he can't even claim that he didn't know about it because people said, hey, you can't do this. And he's like, yeah, I can. And so, and then, and to get to the state of mind, well, maybe he thought that they were wrong. At some point he says, yeah, I just want to do it. Anyway, I know it's wrong and I want to do it. So like this guy has checked every box about being a criminal where at some point, like, that's it. It's just breathtaking.
Yeah. It's breathtaking. And it's funny, Gabe, there's like handwritten notes from Mike Pence about Trump's relentless goading. You know, there's the indictment accuses Trump and his allies of exploiting the disruption caused by supporters with the attack on the Capitol to further spread claims and persuade members of Congress to further delay the certification of votes. Basically, the entire thing is about, like, all the stuff around January 6th kind of boils down to he was trying to get in the way of Congress doing its job, which is a criminal. yeah. Gabe, how do you feel?
I mean, it's wild that you could still run for president while under federal charges, but it's just this continued frustration of, like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Yeah. The people that support him will support him. It doesn't really change anything. Nobody is, I think anybody who's like a hardcore Trumper isn't going to like change their mind at this point because they believe the government is against him anyway. It's really bizarre. Like, it's just this bananas thing where, like, I'm 35. Like, I remember, you know, Howard Dean getting kicked off for screaming. Like, I remember, like, all this stuff that was so scandalous. And now somehow we've ended up here. Like, it's really all the stuff that they accused Hillary Clinton of is, like, what they're doing or what we were so offended as a nation that, you know, Gore and Bush and the votes and blah, blah, blah. And, like, now it's, like, whatever. Like, we got slowly, like, abusive relationship where by the time you're towards the end, you're like, I don't know, this seems normal.
Right, right.
Well, that's such a great point because, you know, part of the reason why this isn't a deal breaker for running for president is because other countries use criminal investigations to go after political opponents and prevent them from serving in the government. So, like, if you're in Russia and you want to run against Vladimir Putin, he can throw you in jail and now you can't run for government.
Oh, my God.
And because that's what other countries like that do. Those are autocratic, you know, governments. And so when our founders crafted, and that was a big thing back, you know, in the time when they had kings, when they were under the king. So our founders were like, we don't want political, investigations to prevent people from serving in government.
Right.
So there was a good reason to do it, but that loophole has been exploited by actual criminals now.
Yeah.
And it used to be, as you were saying, like, that it was a deal breaker for the voters, that sometimes just the investigation would be enough or doing the crimes in public would be enough.
Right.
But to his base, to his supporters, this is a selling point.
Yep.
And that's the scariest thing to me.
And can I? Yeah. It's not dissuading his base. It is, we'll see, you know, we'll see. There's still a lot of time. But I just want to end this by talking about a fun side story where Trump, basically his PAC started out with $105 million last year and is now only $4 million left and has been asking for refunds of money that it has been donating to other pro-Trump super PACs. Because they're spending all the money on legal fees. They're not even really spending it on the campaign. So it's just really hilarious to me. A little fun side note about what's happening there. Here's another piece of dumb news, or is it really important news? I don't know. As of Tuesday, we can no longer buy incandescent light bulbs.
Oh, I saw that.
Sorry, Tony Edison. Yeah.
Why?
I mean, you know, because they're not energy efficient, and you can get the same shit way, way more energy efficient from an LED bulb. I mean, in the interesting thing in reading about this is that it was George W. Bush that was trying to get this going. And this was in the time in the early 2000s where, and for very, very many decades, conservatives were really pro-environment and conserving the environment. So stuff like this was very popular. It wasn't until, I think, the 2000s and the Tea Party and all that stuff that they turned into the anti-environment party. So it's funny to think this ban on incandescent light bulbs started from one of the most famous Republican presidents. So, and here it is. And Trump rolled it back, obviously, and Biden rolled it forward. And here we are.
Interesting. And now that you're saying that about conservatives, it makes total sense because it would, to be very pro-environment would make sense because they want to conserve land and their bases probably are rural and have land and, you know, they're patriotic. So we got to keep the national parks clean and all that stuff. So it is kind of strange, that they pivoted to like, we don't care.
Yeah. No, I know.
Well, I guess oil took over and they're like, fuck a park. We want oil.
Well, the other fun thing about like energy efficiency and stuff like that is one of the places where, first of all, Texas has more renewable energy than any state in the union. Like,
yeah.
Also hilarious to me. Ranchers are really into like kind of putting up windmills and selling the energy back to the grid and all that stuff. They want to be self-sufficient. They want to have energy sources that aren't subject to the whim and fancy of futures trading. And so this gives them that kind of stability. Also, there's that whole rugged, I don't need anyone, you know what I mean?
Right.
I can be alone on the range or whatever.
If you're talking about rugged individualism, you should be energy efficient and environmentally conscious. Because it's like if you're really living off the land, right, you get what you put in. So you have to take care of the land and the land takes care of you. And if you don't want to like pay the man lots of money to make sure your lights turn on, you want to take care of it yourself, you should be going to renewable energy and windmills and solar power and other things like that.
Yeah.
This should be a selling point to libertarians and to rugged individuals.
And it is. I mean, that's the funny thing is it is. There's like these pockets of people out there. And so it's just sort of like getting the rest of the Republicans on board with what these pockets already know to be true. Okay, so that's incandescent light. But let's talk really quickly about how some conservatives aren't happy about Barbie, which is funny because I finally saw the movie. I'm a part of America now. Have you guys seen the movie?
I did, yeah. Did you, Benari?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm seeing it this weekend.
Okay. Well, at least you have a plan because otherwise I was going to have to revoke your passport. But
I haven't seen that. And nor have I seen Oppenheimer.
We won't spoil anything, but you can imagine one of the things that the conservatives say is that it's woke or anti-man. And everyone's favorite, Ben Shapiro, set some dolls on fire in protest, which I thought was funny because I think if you like breathe in those fumes, it'll make you sick. You've seen the movie. Warn us if you're going to spoil anything. But Gabe, what do you think of these protests?
I mean, the lighting dolls on fire is extremely funny. I liked it. I think there was a lot of stuff that was very congratulations, white feminism type situation.
Sure.
Which is sort of funny because I feel like it felt almost like out of time. Like it felt like, wow, are we in 2012? This is wild. In some ways. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting to watch as a trans guy, because I think it's like fun, but also I was like, I don't know. There's certain things that were just very, like, I don't know why, you know, I didn't expect it to have a sort of nuanced leftist view, but yeah, I liked it. I enjoyed it. But I also understand that it's made by a toy company. It's, you know, Mattel isn't exactly the best. There was some stuff, I can't spoil it, but there was certainly something towards the end that I felt a little jolt about as sort of a trans guy. I can't really spoil it, but I guess if you've seen it, you might know what I'm talking about. I don't know. I saw Oppenheimer, and I also read a really great Twitter thread.
Don't spoil the ending of that for me, please.
And a bunch of people on, you know, Twitter talking about Indigenous people and Latino people talking about the ways in which it glosses over the communities in Los Alamos that were affected by the bomb being set off.
That's unsurprising, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, like, right, like, you hate to be a bummer, but then you're like, well, Mattel's labor practices, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know. The movie was fun. I don't think if you're like extremely politically left, don't go into it with high expectations.
Well, and also, I mean, yeah, like, why would you go into any summer tentpole blockbuster movie with expectations that your nuanced political feelings are going to be reflected in this movie that's to be popcorn munching? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's not so, it's in this candy coating, right? We're like, Mission Impossible is very clearly like, we are sort of right wing. And like, even like some of the Marvel movies are like, we are a little bit right wing. Like, so you get this sort of sense. But this has got a little bit of like it's like putting, you know, your medicine. It's like, yeah, it's got a little bit of, this is all fun and games, which like it is. It's amazing that Greta Gerwig has made this film and that it's doing so well. And I've seen people say it's helping them embrace their femininity, and like, I totally get it. And it was a fun film, but yeah, right. Some of it feels, pairing it with Oppenheimer, like a lot of it feels sort of weirdly sinister to me, but maybe I'm just very,
I mean, I think the marketing is very sinister, but yeah, that's what it took to get people. I think that the morbid curiosity and fascination is what got people into the theaters. And you know,
I also love going to movies. I love the cinema. Yeah. I would have seen Oppenheimer by myself, except a friend came with me. Like, I love getting the popcorn, sitting down. Like, the fact that the movies are back is amazing.
That's the other thing. If you want to talk about the number one thing that this movie is promoting, it's naked capitalism. But
I love the movies.
So I'm sort of like, hey, Matt Gaetz' wife, Ginger, who has been tweeting up a storm about hating this movie. Like, don't you love just the money part of it, which is like,
but it's not surprising that they are protesting a movie that is, you know, more that masquerades as a popcorn summer flick that's secretly, sneakily subversive and satirical, and takes your expectations and subverts them and makes them feel uncomfortable because they went in wanting to be, you know, told that like plastic Barbie and plastic Ken are what America is. And then they come out of it being told like, aha, we gotcha, like we tricked you. And you know, that makes them uncomfortable. Anything that makes a conservative think in the movie theater makes them uncomfortable. If they come out thinking something slightly different than they went in thinking, they get so mad.
Well, I mean, I know everyone's wondering, what did Piers Morgan have to say about all of this? And he had to say, if I made a movie mocking women as useless dunderheads constantly attacking the matriarchy and depicting all things feminist as toxic bullshit, I wouldn't just be canceled. I'd be executed.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, I don't think it's spoiler to say that, like,
sorry, 100 years of movie making.
I know. But also, it's also like, I don't know, why doesn't this movie do whatever this movie's doing? And then whatever movie you want to see that doesn't do that thing, then you go see that other movie. That's a lot of the criticism has been like, I wanted more, you know, more material about celebrating faith and family or whatever. And I'm like, well, then this is not the movie. It's about a fucking doll. Yeah. What are you talking about? Then you
Kirk
need to go
Cameron
see a different
movie. Kirk
Cameron
puts out a movie every two months where you get that.
I mean, you've got your stuff. All right, folks, let me know what do you think about the conservative. It's also, I also just want to say, the conservative backlash doesn't feel like it's like sticking in a real way again because
people like it. It's fun and popular.
Because people like it, it's fun. They want to put on their pink outfits. You know what I mean? And like, what part of me is just like, who cares about all of the political ideology that it may or may not be addressing? Just have a good time and put on your pink outfits.
Let's go back to the movies, everyone.
It's so fun. It reminds me of my childhood. It's fantastic.
Heartbreak feels good in a place like this.
That's right. Someone said that before. I don't know who. All right. Let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll continue. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back and we're ready with topic number two. Some call it legacy admissions. Some call it affirmative action for the privileged. It's a practice that is 100% in place in the country's most elite institutions, institutions that have an outsized role in American life. So let me just give you some data here. For example, children of alumni who are usually well off already are nearly four times as likely to be admitted as other applicants with the same test scores. Now, the obvious take that legacy is bad is fair. We talked about this very little bit when the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action came out. And I doubt that either of you will argue with that. I don't know, maybe you will. But my question is, legacy type mobility courses through so much of life, and not just American life, like literally everywhere in every country life. You accept people, you bring them in because you know their families or their friends. They come through a network of recommendation, and this is for every level of working. So what do you think of attacking legacy admissions in that light?
I mean, I think that if you're going to take away the mechanisms that were put in place to level the playing field, to adjust for the default that is legacy admissions, then it's fair to go after legacy admissions. Fine, you took away the mechanism that balances things out. You've replaced an inherent imbalance in the system, because the fact is that legacy admissions on, you know, look, it's always who you know, no matter, like you said, all facets of life. A lot of it is, you know, relationship building. It is building up, you know, family reputation. It is building up. So there's a lot of reputational capital that's mm-hmm. that's there. That's one of the benefits of supposedly leading a good, productive life, is that you also benefit, your children benefit from living a good life and doing the right things and doing it the right way. So, you know, the whole idea, though, that we ignore that totally benefits privileged people, or that that is even a privilege, does a disservice to everything. And so I think that if you're going to say, well, we can't, you know, provide equal opportunity to people who don't have those benefits, we don't provide, you know, we're going to get rid of those mechanisms that help, you know, women who were prevented from going to certain colleges, from, you know, people of color who were prevented from going to colleges, mm-hmm. so they don't have that legacy
yeah.
of my father went here, my grandfather went here, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you're not going to balance that out, then you don't get that benefit either. That's the only way to level the playing field, and we're taking away that benefit from you.
Yeah, but they'll just do it secretly anyway. Like we saw with the college admission scandal and everything like that, they'll just do it anyway. You know, it was not even a question when I was growing up. It was like when you were applying to college, it was like, well, apply to where your parents went, because they'll take that into account. Whereas, like, you know, then friends of mine who were DACA recipients or who, you know, didn't have that, that was not an option for them. So, I mean, I think they'll just take a back channel. You know, it's pessimistic to say, but, like, if they get rid of it, the same people will just be, like, handing little cash over for a library and getting the same benefits.
Well, then maybe we should backdoor equal opportunity. And
I don't know how you do that.
Well, we're in like an underground railroad where like privileged people take people who are like very deserving but don't have those opportunities.
That's
and just
horrible.
Start inserting them to all these like private parties. They're just like, why? Who's that on the yacht over there?
Oh,
that guy's
God.
Not a billionaire's son.
And dangerous. Like, oh, no. That person. That is.
Blow it up.
We'll never see that person again, honestly. It'll be like White Lotus on
He'll
the
be moving into the dark side.
Yeah, no, it'll be really,
you're saying they'll be eliminated. Jesus Christ. Oh, my God.
Dark. Wow.
Well,
that's dark.
I
just thought they would be like, ooh, this private jet is nice. I don't ever want to go back to regular life.
Oh, my God.
I will adopt these ethics.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I've gotten
fam.
A taste and now it's over.
Yeah.
I think I've never even questioned legacy. Like, I've never even thought, I've understood, you know, paying off schools and getting rid of affirmative action and all that bad stuff. It truly has never occurred to me until that, like, this, because I think like when you don't grow up with that sort of thing, you just take it for granted sometimes that rich people have advantages, and you're just sort of like, yeah, they do. But and that I think maybe is how any sort of revolution or any sort of asking for change gets beaten out of you, because I was just like, but that's how it works. And I just don't have it.
Right. Here's another side of it, which is, what do we say to Black and brown families who are like, finally, I made it into legacy circles. Like, we've been around a few decades or whatever. Ugh. My kid can't get that same advantage. And I got to be honest, I did have a millisecond of this thought, which is I didn't have legacy to bolster any of my applications, but my child could. And like, you know, which is, again, that's horrible and gross, and I shouldn't believe in it, and I don't believe in it, right, technically. But also, like, why don't I get to?
That's why you went through all that. Why don't you get to benefit?
Why don't I get to? Why doesn't my kid get it then?
Of course, you're right. I mean, that's such a fucking perfect point of, like, of course we come up to the point where we've finally given people who didn't have the benefit of that for centuries. And we're the first generation of people that do, that otherwise wouldn't have. And then we're not only taking away the ladder
they got there,
but also like any of the benefit of doing it in the fucking first place.
Totally. Totally.
Classic.
I mean, I don't know. Gabe, what do you think?
I don't know. I don't want to speak to people of color because I'm white. I don't want to speak to, you know, I understand like it's so hard because it's all this American dream bullshit that keeps getting foisted on people. And then of course, you know, the person gets out and they can't get a job and they have student loans because they went to a very fancy school or, you know, it's this, I would like to dismantle the entire structure. And I feel like there's been more and more push towards like, you don't have to do this kind of Ivy League thing. You don't have to go to this big school. But then I just did an interview for my show Bad with Money with a career counselor who talked about how people still look at where you went to school down to, and she is a Black woman named Natasha Scott. And she was talking about that, you know, if you went to a historically Black college or university, they'll clock that on your resume. Or if you went to Harvard, they will clock that. And I was like, we're still doing that?
Oh, although, I mean, but I have to be 100% honest. I've been in the position of hiring people. I know that both of you have as well. Yeah. And I also look, where did they go to school? It determines whether or not I hire that person, but like it does say something about the fact that they completed a thing and where did they complete that thing. It is of note. It's interesting. And this is the other huge part of the problem is the culture of hiring, right? So it's like, okay, there's this culture of college admissions, but then the other thing is the culture of hiring, which is obvious. We've all grown up in the same system. Me, with the best of fucking intentions, you know, with family who were like refugees who had to come through the system and get college degrees despite literally everything being against them. Mm-hmm. Looking at a resume and be like, oh, so they went to such and such school. Okay, noted.
You know, because so much of everything runs on vibes. The hiring process, like, you know, staffing process, all of that is like, who do I want to work with or who do I want to spend time with? And when the people in positions of power are doing the hiring, they're going to like the people that have a similar background to them. That's really what it's about. You know, and so if we're not diversifying the highest rungs, the problem is never going to be fixed because those people at the highest rungs are always going to default to hiring the people that are most like them, that they're most comfortable with, and that they know because they're a good guy.
Right. And that's the other thing about the vibes aspect of it is schools want to create a community that's sustained over the long term. You know, they want people to feel a strong alumni connection. They want
people...
So that they donate. So that the school continues to be supported and bolstered by its alumni over decades. Yeah. So, you know, that's the other thing that the school wants. And legacy helps them get there. So I understand from a university's perspective them being like, well, how will we make up for this gap that may emerge because people are not going to feel the same way about donating money.
We all just have to collectively, as Gabe said, like just be like, fucking doesn't matter. We don't care.
We don't care.
It doesn't matter. Like go to a good place. Go to a place that wants you.
Yeah, you know, the go whole, to a place that wants the whole you. Thing is just a racist.
Yeah.
That's all
and
it is.
And can I also say one thing, which is that it's the other thing about this kind of elitism is that, you know, like inflation is supposed to keep, you know, we have an inflation score and we recalculate things. So like tuition goes up based on inflation or based on other things or whatever. Obviously, it's outpaced inflation. So never mind. That was a bad example. But the cost of things go up based on inflation. The amount of stuff increases based on population, right? So like theoretically, like housing should increase because there's more people, whatever, right? Like public transport in New York City, we see increases based on increase in population. Like that's very fucking normal. Now, the population of the America has gone up a bunch since these institutions were founded, but the number of people that they accept and that they educate does not go up, right? So Harvard still only takes in X number of people and educates X number of people. So part of the problem is it becomes increasingly elite, increasingly ridiculous to get in. And then our perception of what is a top-tier school, I don't know why this is the case, but hasn't it broadened, right? There aren't now a few Harvards. They're still just Harvard. I mean, obviously, there's like, you know, Yale and all these other schools or whatever, but like, it's like our understanding of Ivy League, I think it's called like Ivy League Plus or something, and it's just a universe of like 20 schools. Why isn't that 40 schools? Like, just numerically, it has to be larger. Our understanding of elite schools has to be larger to actually reflect that we're more numerous in people, you know? Because
really
the elite
know.
Schools want to keep it elite.
Because they want to keep it elite. That's it. They want the pool, because as the pool increases, their cachet goes up because you're like, look how elite we are. We're even more elite than we were
even
20
more elite.
Years.
Yeah.
Even more elite.
I don't know. And, I went to school in Boston and I met kids from Harvard and they weren't that special. They weren't. Like, it would be that they would just... They were so driven to get, I think the whole system needs to be rethought, because the kids that I met, they were so driven to get into Harvard. And then once they got to Harvard, I would be like, what do you want to do with your life? And none of them fucking knew. So they're not that. And they worked really hard. Either they'll come out with a bunch of student loans or they just coasted in there because of their families and their money. And then they're like, I don't know. And I was like, you guys have nothing to say. And every single person at a vocational school knows what they're going to do. So fuck off.
I mean, that's the case for a liberal arts degree in general.
Harvard, no, because I went to a liberal arts. The liberal arts kids at least know they want to major in liberal arts. The Harvard kids were like, well, we got to Harvard and now we'll just do cool business. I don't know. Like, they were not driven in the same way, I'm telling you.
I mean, sadly, I know a lot of people who went to Harvard who are, in fact, extraordinarily driven, really smart.
All right.
And I get that they were there, why they were there. But I've also seen people, I think the thing is, no one is special at anywhere.
If there's one takeaway from this, it's that no one is special.
No one is
anywhere,
special.
And nobody cares what you do and where you go and who you are. And who you know.
That's exactly right, Benari. That's the
That's
point
the
I feel like we've all been driving towards. No one is special. Folks, let me know what you think. Here's my main question. Do you feel like if you were someone such a person to donate to your school, would you feel less inclined to donate to your school if meant that it had no bearing on your children going there? I don't know if that's a calculation people make when they donate to their schools. Let me know. I'm so curious. Hit me up. And now let us move on to topic number three. We read a piece in the Times called How to Feel Happier at Work When You Have the Urge to Quit by Christina Caron. And this headline really resonated with me because we talk a lot about having the agency to leave a job. And the discourse is always around that. Like, you know, leave a job. You're not happy there. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that a lot of Americans face is that they can't actually leave a job. Maybe not just right now. Maybe they have to do a lot of shit to prepare to be able to leave a job. So what do you do to get through it? Now, before we get into what this article is proposing, have you ever felt like you were at a job and you couldn't leave but you needed to somehow make yourself happier there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were so many places that I was miserable working at that I would have to figure out how to make it at least bearable in some way. Whether it was like having headphones on and being able to maybe listen to music or something while I was
little creature comforts.
Yeah, it was like really, there were a lot of them that were really soul crushing. Like when people are like, it's just your job. I'm like, you don't understand. You spend so much time there. Like it's really, really, it really, really affects you the rest of your life completely. And like, there, you know, my show, again, like, I hate to say Bad With Money again, but like, we've done episodes on quiet quitting, which is just basically doing your job, which I don't know why they gave it a new name. But also, the woman we spoke to, Julia Keller, she wrote a book called Quitting. And the thing is that they were saying quitting is good, actually. But if you can't do that, you can sort of do a thing at your job, which is just do the bare minimum, make sure that you're, you know, taking care of your mental health first and foremost, and not like feeling like you have to rush or go out of your way to do things if you're not going to be monetarily rewarded for those things. And also that it's okay to be looking for other jobs or be doing side hustles or be looking for other things while you're still in the current job. And like, I hate this idea that like, if you get caught doing that, it's like, oh my God, we're a family. How could you betray us? So like, don't get caught, but like, don't think about it as like some sort of moral failing or betrayal if you jump ship. You know, I think that we've been taught that, and you know, that's why people do things and stay late for no promotion or no other reason, because people, they're so scared of confrontation or someone being disappointed in them, when it's like, it's not a family, it's a business.
Benari, you know, what do you think?
Well, not to be all Nagin in Paris here, but when I was in Afghanistan.
Oh, he can't stop talking about his service in the military. God.
And of course, my opinions are my own and in no way reflect those of the United States Army, the United States government, our allies, real or imagined. When I was deployed, I had to be there. And it was like, I was leaving my civilian career. It was interrupting, you know, me trying to become rich and famous and the funny comedian. I got to go to like war. What's this war about? But I was specifically with Afghanistan, I was attached to a unit that I didn't really want to be there. I got pulled in because they needed an extra body in the public affairs slot. So they didn't care. I wasn't cared for. I didn't enjoy being there. I was with this Texas unit. There was a whole lot of anti-Semitism, a whole lot of like, you know, racial politics going on. It was very tumultuous. And it was probably like the angriest I've been like when I was leaving. I was like, it interrupted major career movement for me.
Wow,
and
yeah.
But I had to go do it. And I've come up with this with basically, it's kind of like Gladiator: win the crowd, win your freedom. There was nothing I could do about these circumstances, but to prevent it from being worse or from doing, to make sure that my mental health was okay, I in the areas which I had control over, I tried to do the best I could. I got involved with as many different like programs. I was helping wounded warriors. I got involved with the USO. Wow. I was everywhere. People knew me. I was like, you know what? I'm going to be gregarious. I'm going to be fun. I'm going to be like that guy. So they'd be like, oh, we got you. We love you. So just like a vibes guy again. We're like, people were just happy to see you show up or knowing that the job was done, because then no one was worrying about me or looking for me. And if no one was like worrying about me or looking for me, I could kind of do what I needed to do to keep my mental health and to do the stuff that I could forge more of my own free time to do my extracurricular activities in my free time, because when I was like on the clock, I was like doing the most, but made sure that people saw me, because like you were saying,
yeah,
like people like work so hard and they think that if they do the work but no one sees you doing the work,
right,
it's like you didn't do the work. And this is the biggest takeaway, and not to be, you know, cynical about the whole thing, but like, if you're just doing the work to be a martyr, like there is no reward for that. There is no reward for that except that the work you do. So you either have to love the work or make sure people fucking see you doing the work.
I like this idea of walking around going, I am taking the file to the copier. I am the copier. Hey guys, do you need anything while I go to the copier?
If nothing else, you will have the best time taking files to the copier.
Right. No, I love this. I mean, well, the interesting thing is, one of the things that they talk about in this article is look to your coworkers. And I think you're kind of driving a little bit at that, which is that when I think back, I mean, I've had a million jobs. And when I think about the jobs that like kind of made me miserable, the thing that did it, that I think about are the fun times that I had with coworkers. Right. And, you know, you need coworkers to vent and gossip. But actually, you need coworkers because that's what makes it fun. Like, right. People make a place fun. Mm-hmm. And then if you are fun and you have a good attitude and then your coworkers like, that person's fun, and then you have people to eat lunch with, the entire endeavor changes. It becomes a little micro party you get to go to every day. And so the idea, like, I never discounted my coworkers because those were the people that were keeping me sane. They were making me laugh. You know, it's funny because this article says don't just vent and gossip, but man, venting and gossiping was so fun. I mean, like, in that setting where you're just like, but the other thing is, one of the things the article talks about is find honest and constructive ways of supporting one another. You know, it was interesting because there were things having nothing to do with work. I remember being at a job and I was with an artist, and she was doing like a lot of still lifes and she needed people to sit for her. And so, like, me and another coworker, like, met up with her one day after work and we sat for her. She, like, painted us. You know what I mean? She was like, her goal was to be an artist. And it's like, cool, we met at work, in which you're not an artist. But like, this is your goal. Let's, like, make it happen. And it was fun. It was supporting her as a human felt really good. So I feel like that's something you're driving it as, like, be the guy that people can have a conversation with. That's cool. And I think it really boosts the mood. Another thing that they talked about was to get curious about your job, kind of like trick yourself into being more interested in it.
Right? Interesting.
Like, ask, like, what's inhibiting you? What can you do? What can you control? Meet with managers to discuss your aspirations and then ask for concrete feedback. So basically, like ask a bunch of questions to see if there's ways you can kind of, like, make this thing more interesting for yourself and to trick yourself into being more interested in it.
Maybe talk to other people, just spitballing, like, on LinkedIn who have the same job, or follow some people who have the same job or something. So there's maybe, like, hacks or something like that. Yeah. There's a lot of Reddits. I, like, follow a lot of Reddits for, just out of curiosity, for people who talk about working at a front desk at a hotel, or DoorDash drivers, or people, like, talking about, because I used to do Postmates, like, tales from, you know, your housekeeping staff or whatever, like, different people sharing different stories of their jobs, so that people can, you know, share what's going on, or be like, hey, also this happened to me, or, you know, comment and write and make it a little bit more, oh, like, that's how you dealt with this problem at your work. That's interesting. Like, I could do that too. I don't know. You know, like, just having an outlet, and it's a the internet's a quote unquote free outlet. So maybe that it would help too.
Yeah, I love that. Another thing they talk about is recalibrating your expectations. So I think this is sort of something that applies to us in this time. The pandemic brought a lot of rebellion against work. We talked a lot about the Great Resignation, about quiet quitting. The mindset was that, like, this job sucks. And that kind of became pervasive, even if you maybe didn't necessarily think that your job sucked, or, you know what I mean? It kind of became this global, this job sucks vibe. And I think the question that the article asks is, like, how useful is that for you now? You know what I mean? And it's so irritating, but a lot of this is, like, the mindset, like, be more optimistic. Is it realistic for you to have more expectations of this job than this job is going to, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what is the job supposed to fucking give you, like, a euphoric zen? Like, realistic are we to expect that of these jobs?
But I think this is another kind of point, which is, for so long, the job was who you were. And your job is not who you are. Mm-hmm. It's what you do.
Yes.
And what you do, like, okay, you might not like the job itself because it's work and you want to be doing something else, but you always have the opportunity to do the best you can at whatever you're doing. And that doesn't define you. Just because you're a data analyst all day doesn't mean that's your whole personality or your life.
Right.
So, like, if you focus on, like, okay, this is the job, I'm a data analyst, so I'm going to just fucking be an awesome data analyst, but I have all these other passions and I have all these other thoughts and I have other communities over here. Don't worry about your job defining you. You can define what it is to be that person in that job. And I think when you come at it with that mentality.
This is how the French do it, guys. Coming back. Let's always get Paris. Back to Paris. This is how the French do it. All right, folks, let me know. What do you think? Have you figured out a hack to make yourself happier at work? I'm so curious to hear. All right, that is the end of the show. Oh, my God. I mean, you're both a couple of my all-time faves, listeners' faves. And what I want you to do is to tell the listeners where they can find you and follow all the wonderful things that you do. Benari Lee Poulton, where do they do that?
On whatever socials are still out there, at Benari Lee, B-E-N-A-R-I-L-E-E, as long as, I don't know. I mean, it's all burning to the ground. So, you know, there it is.
There it is.
Win the crowd, win your freedom.
Wow.
And Gabe Dunn, where do they find you?
I'm Gabe S. Dunn on Instagram. I'm mostly on Instagram. You can find out more about projects that I'm working on. One is at You and I, You and Me Film, which you can go to on Instagram. I have a podcast called Just Between Us. I have a podcast called Bad with Money. And I have a brand new show with River Butcher called The New Guys, which is it's a couple of trans guys talking about everything. So you can go to any of those. And but mostly you can find everything on Gabe S. Dunn on Instagram.
I mean, I'm sure you devoted an entire episode to the fact that you're both Fake the Nation alum.
Yeah, that's what we talked about.
Needless to say.
Yeah.
That's so exciting that you have a new pod with River.
Thanks.
Such a fan of you both. Folks,
thank you.
Subscribe to all the pods that Gabe just talked about. Learn about the movie that they're hopefully going to go into production on soon. And as for me, you know where to find me and all the things that I do. But I just want to remind listeners that I'm going to be in St. Paul on August 18th. And Kansas City on August 19th. I'm going to be in Chicago. So that's for stand-up, the Wait, Don't Tell Me stand-up tour. But then on August 24th, I'm going to be in Chicago doing Wait, Don't Tell Me. So a regular Wait, Don't Tell Me. So if you're in Chicago that night, would love to see you. And otherwise, I want to thank everyone who makes the show a possibility. That's our fantastic producer, Andrew McGuire. Our wonderful theme music was written by Gabby Alter. Thanks to everyone at HeadGum for making the show a possibility. If you have any thoughts that you want to share with us, you can do that at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. And we will be back in your earballs next week. That was a HeadGum Podcast.